Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, another year has flown by. 2015 was action-packed in the healthcare arena, as it seems to be every year of late. It's a good time to look back at some of the year's industry's highlights.
And there were quite a few, Mark. The healthcare law survived another Supreme Court challenge in June, the King versus Burwell decision. That upheld the legality of the Affordable Care Act's premium subsidies and averted a health insurance market meltdown, really.
And for the first time in several years, the Affordable Care Act wasn't the top story, Margaret. The high cost of pharmaceuticals topped the list of health industry stories this year, whether it's the $85,000 price tag to treat just one patient with Hep C, or the hedge fund company that bought a decade-old drug and hiked up the prices by 5,000%. It's indicative of a much larger problem. Drug costs are skyrocketing, and it's leading cost of inflation in the healthcare sector, which topped 5% growth in 2015, the biggest hike since the health law was passed.
Well, that is really amazing. And we do have a tendency to go try and find some silver lining in these stories, Mark. And one for this issue is that in recent years, transparency has begun to allow consumers to understand what is behind the health costs impacting their bottom lines. Lawmakers, health industry activists, providers, payers, all are jumping on the bandwagon of transparency, calling for something to be done to contain this extreme high cost of pharmaceuticals. And I think that's a trend that's likely to continue into 2016 as we see more transparency around healthcare costs, not just in pharmaceuticals, but across the board.
And Margaret, another big story that actually was a non-story. It's the long-awaited switch to ICD-10 billing codes. The switch was dubbed healthcare's Y2K, and indeed, that's how it played out. The new coding went into effect in October, and for the most part, the transition has been a smooth one. The switch to ICD-10 will, over time, give us some more granular data on healthcare spending and outcomes. So fortunately, this shift has finally taken place.
Yeah, and maybe we finally learned that training and preparation and planning are good things
they
in
all
healthcare.
Work.
They all worked. 2015 was also a year of mergers and acquisitions among many health systems and insurance companies around the country. As the health system continues to jockey for position in this changing landscape. And I also note that more medical schools have been announced. Kaiser Permanente is leveraging its integrated high-quality care model to create a new kind of medical school. Their focus, training next-generation clinicians to be able to advance population health and promote sustainable health costs at the same time.
You know, Kaiser CEO Bernard Tyson says creating a medical school to prepare clinicians for the Kaiser method of care delivery makes sense, especially as a U.S. health system shifts towards value-based coordinated care into the future. Margaret, it sounds a little like our own residency program.
It does indeed. And Dr. Christine Castle, CEO of the National Quality Forum, has announced that she'll leave her post to run this new Kaiser Permanente School of Medicine. Seems like a perfect fit when you think about it. She's focused much of her career on improving quality and safety in the healthcare space, and she's also one of the nation's top thought leaders in creating improved quality metrics in healthcare. And because of that recent announcement, we thought we'd revisit our conversation with her from earlier this year.
And also, we hear from Lori Robertson. She always is on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to CHC Radio.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we love to hear from you. We'll get to our interview with Dr. Christine Castle in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Opioids and overuse. It's reached crisis-level proportions in this country, with 250 million opioid prescriptions being doled out in the past 10 years and more than 150,000 opioid overdoses reported, as well as a dramatic increase in heroin addiction, dovetailing off that volume. As it's far cheaper than prescription opioids for addicts to obtain, there's a growing call for the medical profession to curb those prescriptions, and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid is getting involved. The CMS plans to more closely track the use of opioids by adults and antipsychotics among children and adolescents with the new quality measures for Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program. The agency issued a notice outlining the new measures, which come amid a national epidemic of opioid abuse and a rising unease about the high rates of antipsychotic medications prescribed to minors. About 28,600 people died in 2014 alone from overdoses of prescription painkillers, heroin, and other opioids. The CDC says the figure is the highest on record and has tripled since the year 2000. The CMS will require Medicaid programs, starting no later than December 2016, to track the use of opioids at high dosages acquired from four or more providers and pharmacies by beneficiaries who don't have cancer. The measure is intended to indicate inappropriate prescribing or fragmented care, according to the Pharmacy Quality Alliance, which endorsed the measure. The American Pharmacists Association said the new Medicaid measures could help identify patterns of opioid misuse. 2015 also saw a dramatic rise in cybersecurity issues and health industry hacks, with millions of Americans' health information having been compromised. The healthcare information technology sector is hailing. The healthcare information technology sector is hailing healthcare-specific cybersecurity provisions that have made their way into the massive omnibus legislation Congress recently passed. The $1.1 trillion spending and tax extender bill includes language that closely follows the recommendations from HIMSS, the Healthcare Information and Management Systems Society, as well as other groups pushing for greater government support to combat cyber threats. The legislation creates a healthcare industry cybersecurity task force to be established within the law's first 90 days. The task force will study how other industries combat cyber threats, as well as technical and other challenges that make the healthcare industry vulnerable to such attacks. Concussions are a real health threat in this country, not just professional football players, but athletes across the age and gender spectrum. House and Energy Commerce Committee Chair Fred Upton is proposing an initiative to study the depth of the prevalence of concussion and whether current treatment protocols are sufficient enough to mitigate the aftermath of concussion, Upton calling concussion a true public health threat. Meanwhile, a $16 million grant has been given to brain researchers to seek a way to diagnose chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which currently can't be determined until a patient has died. The new study, considered among the most ambitious in the field of sports-related brain injury, aims to develop ways to spot the disease in the living and figure out why some players get it and others do not. A more comprehensive understanding of the disease, the researchers say, will lead to better ways to prevent it. The National Institutes of Health is fully funding the CTE study, saying it didn't want NFL money influencing the outcome of the research in any way. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Christine Castle, President and CEO of the National Quality Forum, a nonprofit membership organization that works to help improve health and healthcare quality through measurement. An internist and specialist in geriatric medicine, Dr. Castle served as President and CEO of the American Board of Internal Medicine. She serves on the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. Dr. Castle is a former president of the American College of Physicians and has published extensively. Her most recent book is Medicare Matters. She's consistently named on Modern Healthcare's 100 Most Influential list. Dr. Castle, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, and the Quality Forum was set out to create a best-in-class standards and metrics that could be used to improve the nation's quality of healthcare. Could you share with our listeners about how far we've actually come since the National Quality Forum was established?
Well, if you think back to 1999, it was a time where we had very little open information for consumers or even for providers about the quality of care. If you think about it, even Google had just barely been created around that time.
So hard to believe.
It's hard to imagine, but that's how long ago it was. So we've come a long way, and NQF has been right in the center of helping to set standards for what measures are actually accurate. But I would say we have a long way to go. But NQF's role has been all along the one place that includes all the perspectives from stakeholders, public and private, as well as a very strong voice of consumers and purchasers. if you look at just the last 4 years, we've seen a dramatic reduction, almost 20% reduction in hospital-acquired conditions like infections, 50,000 lives saved, and $12 billion. So that would not have happened if we hadn't been able to measure those things and then report back to people and allow them to find ways to reduce those kinds of events. Same kinds of level of improvements, actually even more dramatic in maternity care, in reducing unnecessary hospitalizations and readmissions. So I think the place to really look for results in this area is within hospitals and community-based institutions where people now are able to look at the quality of care and the patient mm-hmm. experience and collaborating regionally or even nationally to figure out how to reduce problems and improve quality.
You know, Dr. Kessel, you've said that to create a truly gold standard for quality measures, you've got to have all stakeholders at the table. How do you arrive at quality measures in a way that satisfies all the stakeholders that are at the table?
Well, it's actually what makes NQF so unique. There really isn't another organization like this. The NQF is really the only place that comes together around an open, transparent process, particularly having the strong consumer voices at the mm-hmm. table. So we have roughly 12 to 14 different ongoing standing committees. We have 850-plus volunteers on all these expert and multi-stakeholder committees, so helping us come to consensus. You know, we're seeing more and more controversial measures now because payment is so strongly attached to so many of them, and that's not surprising. One of the things we're able to do through our consensus process is get to the most practical results.
You've talked about these tensions that weigh heavily on the industry. We had Dr. Stephen Stack, who's the president of the AMA, on describing that his membership is drowning in reporting requirements. Could you talk to our listeners about these industry challenges and the need for better science behind the measurements?
It is really true that the demand for better information is kind of hitting the doctors with all these different requirements, and there really is a need to align the measures to get all of the different people who are using similar measures but not exactly the same together and try to reduce the redundancy. It's interesting, you know, when I first came to NQF, literally 50% of the people I talked to said that we're drowning in measures. Mm-hmm. The other 50% are saying we don't have enough measures. From the doctor's perspective, if you're a neurosurgeon, we actually don't have good measures that measure what you do. And if you're a patient and you have an unusual condition, or actually not that unusual, like let's say multiple sclerosis, you want to know about that, and we don't have good measures for that. So I call this the Goldilocks problem. We have too many measures and not enough measures, and we don't have the right measures. So we need just the right measures, and that's where measurement science comes in.
Hmm. Well, Dr. Kessel, what kind of system changes have come about because of having access to better data, because of these quality measures? Give us maybe some examples of the system changes within that led to the better outcomes, and also if you have examples of some health systems across the country that you really think are getting this data sharing right.
If I can point to Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic, Geisinger, Denver Health, Kaiser, Intermountain, Mass General and partners, and each of them, they report these national metrics to the federal government and to state payers, Medicaid, and the private payers as well. And a lot of people are just literally learning from one another the science of quality improvement. Mm-hmm. And that includes putting in place reminders, checklists mm-hmm. that for safety and the every single time you go into the operating room, because that's how you prevent errors from happening. So recently, a number of hospitals have done amazing things in reducing readmission by following up with their patients, and some even giving their patients an iPad to take home with them that reminds them to take their medication, has them able to communicate seamlessly with a nurse at the hospital. Lots of sort of creative ideas like that.
We're speaking today with Dr. Christine Castle, President and CEO of the National Quality Forum, a national collaboration of stakeholders aimed at improving health and healthcare quality through measurement. Dr. Castle also served as President and CEO of the American Board of Internal Medicine. Dr. Castle, let's talk about the incentive movement, and we're seeing this shift from volume to value. HHS and Secretary Burwell recently announced some very ambitious goals for the coming year, including ensuring that 90% of Medicare outcomes are tied to quality. Is the National Quality Forum engaged in conversations with them about this reach?
We are very definitely, Mark, engaged in conversations with them and with the private payers as well, because they're moving down this road too. They all are part of a national effort called the Learning and Action Network that's trying to align the efforts of the private sector and the public sector. NQF has been very clear in our measurement science work to say you're not going to be able to just use cost alone and still have consumers know that they're getting value, because value is cost plus quality. Mm-hmm. It's really about getting rid of the waste and unnecessary cost in healthcare and paying for what really does benefit the patient. Some physicians and some healthcare systems and hospitals are way far along. They've been doing this for a long time, and they know how to think about patient-centered care in a way that doesn't ask every time, is this going to get paid for or not? Mm-hmm. But for many providers, it's a whole new way of thinking about how you collect information, how you organize your teams, and how you interact with your patients. Providing really good quality data that both providers and their own patients can understand and that they really believe in is dramatically motivational. If they are using data that they believe, they will say, I never realized that I wasn't checking lipids in my diabetics, because we didn't have the data systems to make that visible to folks before.
Well, Dr. Castle, let's maybe take a moment to look at some areas of interest to you personally. Prior to heading the National Quality Forum, you were the CEO of the American Board of Internal Medicine and the ABIM Foundation. And 3 years ago, ABIM launched the Choosing Wisely campaign that called for providers as well as patients to curtail the overuse of dozens of costly, often unnecessary, and sometimes even dangerous common procedures and medications. Share with us, what kind of impact has the Choosing Wisely campaign had been? How do you see that movement evolving in this era of both consumer-driven and also value-driven healthcare?
I am so proud of having been involved in that at the very beginning. And, you know, it was, in a way, something that came from the profession itself, who were beginning to look at all of the concern about the rising cost of care and say, you know, we own a piece of this, and we can be helpful by identifying areas in our own practice that are overused, often because patients have those expectations,
right,
too. I think the insight that we had at ABIM Foundation was we need to get the doctors and the patients together to talk about this message, because so often when you begin talking about cost of care and reducing overuse, people are worried about rationing,
right.
And so let's just have the medical experts and patient groups. We were so fortunate to have a robust partnership with Consumer Reports, and I think that was the magic of Choosing Wisely. And now, as you've seen, it's kind of entered the vernacular. This has coincided in an interesting way with the rise of more high-deductible insurance programs.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it came just at a time when consumers needed this, because often that first dollar payment is actually something that comes out of their pocket.
You know, let me give a quick shout out to one of our own staff physicians, Dr. Stephen Smith, who's one of the founders of the Choosing Wisely movement. And
well, Steve was there right at the very beginning and actually brought the idea initially to us, along with the National Physicians Alliance.
And speaking of great physicians, you're certainly a world-renowned expert in geriatric medicine, and Medicare, as we know, celebrated its 50th anniversary. Your book, Medicare Matters, What Geriatric Medicine Can Teach American Healthcare, you note that Medicare is perhaps the most important healthcare program of our time. And I wonder if you can share with our listeners a little bit about what we learned about the evolution of Medicare, as well as the evolving discipline of geriatric medicine.
I first would point out that those 10,000 people a day who are turning 65 are by and large not what we think of as a geriatric patient. And between the ages of 65 to 75, probably even up to 80, people are living longer and staying healthier as they age. But part of the price of getting old is that you do develop a number of age-related conditions. The specialty of geriatrics is unique because it understands the science behind aging, the distinction between treating a disease and treating a patient who has multiple chronic conditions, and all of it is patient-focused, which is, of course, something we want all healthcare to be now. And that's why geriatric medicine can teach American healthcare, because looking at what are a patient's values, but let's have a partnership between the patient and their family and organize the care around that set of values, which frankly might sometimes be putting different priorities in place than a standard medical guideline would have. So that's where I think the specialty of geriatrics could add a lot. It's also totally committed to coordination of care, so having multiple specialists very interactive with one another, so none of them are interacting in a bad way and everybody knows what everybody else is doing, and trying to keep people out of nursing homes, out of hospitals, but when they are in nursing homes and hospitals, being able to communicate and organize the care to be the best care it can be. So geriatricians work very closely with nurses and social workers and physical therapists and others. But I think the innovations, you know, Medicare's also been an innovator in terms of data for reporting and in terms of now all of the advances of the ACA. So I think that all of the creative approaches to driving care that's more coordinated in some ways come from those roots within the early days of Medicare and the specialty of geriatric medicine. Mm-hmm.
Well, Dr. Castle, I was glad to hear you allude to some other members of the healthcare team there a moment ago. And I know that in your role at the National Quality Forum, the issue of interprofessional practice must arise, but also that among the stakeholders, although we've primarily focused in the conversation on physicians, you must have represented the other clinical professions in particular that play an important role in the healthcare delivery system, the PAs and the nurse practitioners and the health psychologists and others. Tell us maybe just a little bit about how the National Quality Forum has, you know, since it was founded, you know, back in the late 90s, really transformed who's at the table in terms of an interprofessional perspective on how from in clinical practice we achieve these transformations in the direction of better quality.
Well, we have a large number of medical specialty societies who are members of NQF, but we also have a very large number of nursing organizations. Pharmacy is huge. I mean, when we think about how the world of pharmacy uses data and to make sure that they deliver the accurate medication to the right patient at the right time, what's interesting to me about this transition and what I call measurement science is that we've tended to focus on the doctor measures because that's who gets paid. But in fact, more and more everybody is recognizing that the quality of the care that is given can be attributed to a team, either a small team or a larger system and in a group practice. And frankly, my perspective as a physician and as a geriatrician is that more and more I think we should be reporting team outcomes and system outcomes rather than the individual. And that's going to, of course, depend on changing of payment and models and things like that.
We've been speaking with Dr. Christine Castle, President and CEO of the National Quality Forum. You can learn more about their work by going to qualityforum.org, or you can follow them on Twitter at NAT Quality Forum. Dr. Castle, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
You're most welcome. I've enjoyed it.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
What does the coming year mean for those who don't purchase health insurance? Higher penalties under the Affordable Care Act. the healthcare law called for penalties for those who don't have health insurance, with some exemptions, mainly based on income or economic hardship, and the amount of the penalty was phased in over 3 years beginning in 2014. That means the penalties hit their highest point next year. For 2016, the penalty will be either a flat fee or a percentage of family income, whichever amount is greater. The flat fee is $695 per adult, plus another $347.50 per uninsured child. That maximum penalty per family is $2,085. For those paying a greater amount under percentage of income, that penalty is 2.5% of family income above a certain threshold. That's about $10,000 for an individual and about $20,000 for a family. So, for instance, an individual earning $40,000 a year would pay about $750 for not having health insurance based on the percentage fee. But an individual earning $30,000 would pay the flat $695. The increase for 2016 means a doubling of the flat fees and a bump up of a half of a percent in the percentage penalties. The nonpartisan Kaiser Family Foundation estimates that the average household penalty in 2016 for those who could have purchased insurance on the ACA marketplaces would be $969. And the average household penalty for those who could have purchased such a plan but not with the help of subsidies would be $1,450. The penalty is prorated if you had insurance for part of the year. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Of the 6.6 million births per year in this country, over half are unattended. And among teens, those rates are even higher. Colorado has been conducting an experiment for several years to examine what might happen if sexually active teens and poor women were offered the option of long-term birth control, such as IUDs or implants. The first question to answer, would they take the offer?
What was so striking was the word of mouth amongst these young women to each other and the network of support that was built amongst these young women to access this program through these clinics and to help the tens of thousands of women over the course of the 4 to 5 years really did then result in these significant decreases in unintended pregnancies and abortions.
Dr. Larry Wolk is medical director of the Colorado Department of Health and Environment. He says the results were nothing short of astounding.
The resultant decrease is 40% plus or minus in both categories, pregnancy and abortion, over these 4 to 5 years. And I'll give you a sneak peek preview into preliminary data for 2014, for which it looks like those reductions may be even more dramatic when you extend this out over an additional year to more than 50, even approaching 60% reduction in those unintended pregnancies and abortions.
And the results showed not only a dramatic decrease in unintended pregnancies, there was a significant economic benefit to the state as well.
We've seen a significant decrease in the number of young moms and kids applying for and needing public assistance, whether that's public insurance, whether that's through the WIC program. You know, we hope that then longer term, this will translate into better social and economic outcomes for these folks and for us as a state and our state's population.
And in spite of what conventional wisdom might lead one to assume, the incidence of sexually transmitted diseases dropped in this population as well.
We've been doing background surveillance of our sexually transmitted diseases here in Colorado. And amongst young women 15 to 24, we've seen a decrease in sexually transmitted infections and the rates are now below the national averages.
Many other state health departments are already consulting with Colorado on the successful outcome of their experiment, a free, long-term contraception program offered to at-risk teens and women trying to avoid the economic hardship of unplanned pregnancies, leading to a number of positive health and economic outcomes for all involved. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.